Hello and welcome to the Mariner's Library with me, Chris Stanmore Major. And in this episode, we're concluding the book In Broken Water by Adlard Coles. We're on chapter 12, and this is the seventh part of the reading. And if you haven't already, please consider going over to patreon.com/themariner, and there for $5 a month, you can help support this podcast and keep the information contained within these fantastic books easily available for the next generation. Now on with the story. Chapter 12. Through Friesland to the Zuider Zee. During the night, a succession of thunderstorms passed, bringing with them hard squalls of wind and pelting rain. The next day, August the 23rd, there was, as usual, a fresh westerly headwind, and things looked so unpromising that we decided to go through Holland again by canal. Our original intention had been to make a bold bid for it and run across to any part of England. However, we never even had a chance of making a start. The wind had blustered about from the west for weeks together, and we had not had a steady east wind since July the 14th. On the German coast, it seemed hardly exaggeration that year to say that a northwest gale might be expected from a rising barometer, a south or southwest gale with rain from a falling barometer, and a continual hard blow from the west if it remained steady. That had been our experience, so we reluctantly abandoned the idea of a direct crossing and instead sailed round into the harbour at Delfzyl and tied up alongside a barge. Her two seamen spoke English fluently, and we were very glad of their help. One of them accompanied me to the customs, bought provisions and procured us a new anchor of about 30 pounds weight for the moderate price of 8 guilders or 15 shillings. I also bought some rigging screws and other small gear. I found prices in Holland quite fair, generally, and ship's gear was really cheap. Food in restaurants seemed to be the only expensive item. The seamen arranged for a net to be towed to the Zuider Zee for £3, and helped us through the locks and tying us up alongside the tug. I dare say the tow might have been arranged more cheaply, but the two seamen saved us endless time and trouble, so I did not question the price. That evening, we had a good many visitors of one sort or another. A collection of boys eyed the yacht with interest, but could not trouble us much as the tug lay between us. When going through the locks, we had witnessed a very funny sight. Two big lockmen were opening the gates and were being pestered by half a dozen children, who refused to keep out of the way. The larger of the men suddenly lost patience and picked up two of the yelling youngsters, put one under each arm, quietly strolled across to the canal, and ducked them both soundly. The picture was truly Dutch. The men in their red braided hats, the bargees, peasants, the children in Dutch clothes, all roaring with good-humoured laughter, and the two unfortunate infants, dripping with water, being led home hand in hand by a sympathetic sister. One of our visitors was a very self-important young man of about 18. He was attired in a smart blue reefer suit plastered with gold anchors, and his pasty face was almost lost under his huge, white-topped, peaked cap. First of all, he asked politely if he could come aboard, and I said yes. He talked for a little in atrocious English, about the standard of Dunsterville's German or my French, and informed us he was studying at a nautical school and that his father was the best pilot in the world. He said he would pilot us to Lemma and that he only wanted his return railfare paid. The cheapness of his terms brought loud disapproval on his head from all the rival pilots crowding the quay. The Dutchman refused to believe we did not want a pilot. You are an English yacht, and the canals are very difficult. Besides, you cannot speak Dutch. They argued on and on until I went below to peel potatoes. The nautical student eyed me reproachfully for some time, then broke out solemnly, "That is no work for you. That is not right." "What?" I replied, and he jumped below and without a further word brought out a large navigation school knife and started to help me. He then talked on and on, offering himself as pilot, and finally, peering forward into our wet and crowded forecastle, "Yes, I will come as ship's boy, for nothing," he murmured. Little did he know what life on a net meant. His brass anchors and creased serge trousers would only be fit for a pawn shop within a week. He stayed with us whilst I boiled a stew, and he would not take the broadest hints to leave. I restrained myself for some time, as he was so pitifully eager to join us, for pure love of sailing, apparently. However, in the end, I told him point blank to get out. He looked confused, and Dunsterville hurriedly added, "And now you must go home to dinner." He left, looking very sad, and said he would see us again the next day. We were always being pestered by people who wanted to come with us under any conditions. In Germany, of course, everybody wanted to work their way to England, the land flowing with milk and honey. Even the waiter at the Heikendorf Inn implored us to let him work his passage. Little did they realise they would only be added to the ranks of the unemployed, with only a diminutive dole. In Holland, things were worse, and as I said, everybody wanted to pilot us. Pilots are absolutely unnecessary for a yacht drawing 4 feet of water, and are also a great nuisance. Half the fun of cruising lies in exploring, and one does not welcome the presence of a stranger. At daybreak, we tied up to a large barge, as instructed, and the two of us were towed at good speed by a motor tug along an uninteresting canal 20 miles to Groningen. Here we were cast off, and we warped a net through the locks and along the canal, tying up to Ems 2, a very powerful steam tug which was to tow us to Lemmer on the Zuider Zee. Groningen is the capital of the most northerly province of Holland and is something of a Clapham junction of canals, although a picturesque one. We should certainly have got lost in the maze of canals had it not been for the generous help of the harbour master. He spoke English fluently and was of great assistance to us. We set off at 6:30 p.m. the same day, behind about 8 big brightly coloured barges. Progress was painfully slow and the canal crowded with shipping, so we did not get beyond the outskirts of Groningen before nightfall. The whole line of us tied up to the bank, and the two bargees off the ship next to us came aboard for a drink and to listen to the gramophone. They brought with them little Timothy, as we nicknamed him, a very small, solemn-looking boy, aged 7. He had close-cropped hair and a round head with grave, troubled eyes. He sat on the companionway step, quietly munching chocolate and looking around him with mild interest, whilst we talked to his father. The latter did not speak a word of English, and as we did not speak Dutch, we did not discuss any problems of vast importance. We managed to understand each other fairly well in spite of that difficulty. Dunstable claims it was because of his German, and I must admit it had improved considerably since we were at Norderney. We proceeded leisurely through the canals for 3 days, tying up each night alongside the bank. Every day it blew hard from the west, bringing strong winds and rain, so we were glad of our decision to use the canals, as progress outside would have been impossible. One of those days was a Sunday, so we found ourselves, much to our disgust, free for 12 hours, as no work was done. We slept late in the morning and then got up for a hard walk through the flat surrounding country. Next day our route took us right through the Friesland Meres, charming scenery which made us wish we could see it in better weather. The Meres are large expanses of water like the Norfolk Broads. They are well buoyed and should provide excellent sport for those who like inland sailing. We passed a number of Dutch yachts on the way and saw a large one run full tilt into the bank at full speed with a smart following breeze. The barge in front of us had got aground and had swung right across the channel, so that the yacht had the choice of colliding with the great iron ship or the bank. She naturally chose the latter and in some inexplicable way did not seem to get damaged. Accidents are always happening on the canals when there is any wind, as they are so crowded with shipping, some fast-moving and some slow. Many of the barges are so large as to be almost unmanageable, and the bridges add considerably to the trouble. Annette had many narrow escapes in inland Holland, and her scarred sides bore witness to the fact that ditch crawling is not necessarily peaceful. We found the Dutch people very friendly and received a great deal of help from the barge immediately in front of us, who always tended our warps and told us the right method of doing things. We saw quite a lot of Timothy. On Sunday morning, we heard a crash on the deck and rushed up to find the cause of the trouble. The angelic child was throwing bricks at us. Dunstable, in his best German, explained why we did not like bricks. Timothy stared at him in a puzzled way for a moment, then turned round to chastise some hens. Dutch children are little demons, but mischievous rather than malicious. We parted from this specimen on the best of terms. When we arrived at Lemmer, it was blowing hard, so we lay alongside the barge for the rest of the day, it then being early morning. Timothy had been peering through the cabin porthole and kept on putting his hand through in the hope of picking something up. In the morning, I had purchased a long blue pennant to fly at the truck like a Dutchman. It had the Dutch flag at the end, which I cut off. This I put in Timothy's inquiring hand, and when he pulled it out, there was a howl of joy, which brought his papa and mama from below, thinking their only son had come to grief. We were sorry afterwards to have parted with it, as Timothy was not content and made several piratical raids on our boat hook, which he wanted to take as a flagstaff. Next day, August the 29th, we passed through the sluice into the Zuider Zee. The wind was, of course, directly against us, so we decided to make for Enkhuizen on the opposite side of the Zuider Zee, on one tack and then south along to the Horn on the next. The wind was moderate but variable, so we were not off Enkhuizen before 3 p.m. In the middle of the Zuider Zee, a puff of wind got under our chart, which was mounted on varnished cardboard, lifted the drawing pins and blew it overboard. Dunsterville got into the dinghy and went after it. There was plenty of sea and wind for an 8-foot pram, and our crew looked very small as he rowed about looking for the missing card. Difficulty was experienced in picking him up, as I had to run back and jibe before fetching him. The wind later on fell and backed to southeast, accompanied by a rapidly falling barometer. It looked like trouble, but we carried on for Horn, which we eventually made at 6 p.m. and ran in under bare poles before a gale. It blew an exceptionally hard gale that night and all the following day. We were told later that things were so bad in the North Sea that a German steamer had gone down near Eimuiden in deep water simply through stress of weather, with the loss of 40 hands. Things being so bad, we spent the next day ashore. Horn is termed the Queen of the Zuider Zee. The town, with its houses and its spires, is certainly very beautiful, but so also is Enkhuizen, which makes a lovely picture as it is approached from the sea. A feature of Horn is the cheese market, where they handle huge quantities of round cheeses, just like cannonballs. These are carried about in stretchers by pairs of porters. The moment the stretchers are put down, they are pounced upon by uniformed officials, who then throw them to other officials. It looked like some kind of game with giant cricket balls. Not only was the market full of cheeses, but they seemed to overflow into the rest of the town. There were warehouses full of them, and there were cheeses in the shops, the ships, and even in the streets. Chapter 13. In the Canals. We saw the last of the cheeses next morning, and left Horn at 4:30 a.m. The course was first southerly, round the elbow of land and the island of Marken on the southwest side of the Zuider Zee, and then westerly to Amsterdam. It was a fine day, but the wind was light and variable and continually headed us. It seemed to bear Annette a grudge, but we managed to get to Amsterdam by 2 o'clock. We passed the Royal Netherlands Yacht Club, where flags were flying, bands playing, and the club crowded with people. It was a brilliant scene under the August sun. Fast mahogany motor launches tore about, and two big rowing boats lay alongside the entrance with oars raised at the salute. For a moment we wondered what all the fuss was about, and then we remembered it was Jubilee Day. From the general excitement we gathered the Queen herself was present. It was embarrassing for us, as we had to pass close, and compared with the other yachts, poor old Annette was looking very woebegone after her long cruise, and the canals had sadly damaged her paint. We ourselves must have looked like tramps, unshaven and wearing old flannel trousers and dirty unwashed shirts. The Red Ensign flew bravely at the peak, and it would be insulting the Dutch flag if it was not dipped at such an occasion. I generously offered Dunsterville the opportunity of making the salute, but he also, with laudable unselfishness, refused the privilege, so that I, feeling very foolish, had to go forward in full view of the smart gathering to dip it myself. The salute was answered, Dunsterville said, but I went below until we reached less fashionable waters. We were sailing once more in the North Sea Canal for Eimuiden. The canal was as usual crowded with shipping, and as there was a headwind, progress was slow and navigation difficult, since we had to tack across the canal and cross the path of the shipping. Near Zaandam Bridge, I made a very silly mistake. I tried to cross the bows of a tug with only about 100 yards between us. The wind was very light, and at the critical moment it died on us. We managed to get Annette onto the other tack. The tug missed colliding with us, but it was a close shave with the cargo ship she was towing. She missed us by a very narrow margin, and I was just in time to pull the dinghy in to avoid it being struck. There was a good deal of cursing, which I thoroughly deserved, as, but for the skipper smartly putting the ship's helm over, we should have certainly been lost. Her bows seemed like a wall of steel rushing at us. I never before realised how bluff are the bows of a tramp steamer, and never want to do so again. We continued beating westwards in the canal until 9 p.m., when we anchored 5 miles from Eimuiden. Next morning, September the 1st, we were up early at 4:30 a.m., but we were delayed by a swing bridge which closed in our faces just as we reached it. It took over 5 hours to cover the 5 miles to Eimeoudon. At noon, the wind freshened from west by south, which meant a headwind along the coast outside, so I decided to go through the canal to Haarlem and thence to Rotterdam and down the Maas to the Hook of Holland. We received our mail at Eimeoudon and did some provisioning, so we did not get underway again until the following morning, when we ran back along the North Sea Canal and took a canal on the south side which led to Haarlem. We were delayed a long time at the locks and again at the railway bridge, so we just got to Haarlem at 1 o'clock. It was Sunday, and the bridges spanning the canal there opened only at midday for an hour, so as we were just too late, we had to waste the whole afternoon until the bridges opened again in the evening. To make matters worse, the glass rose steadily and the wind slowly veered to northeast. We were missing a fair wind at sea and were boxed up in compulsory idleness. Haarlem is a beautiful town, but we were hardly in the mood to appreciate its attractions. I went ashore to have a look round and found the place in a state of great festivity. The streets were crowded with inhabitants, in their Sunday best, wearing orange favours or colours. Orange Japanese lanterns hung overhead, and orange streamers were everywhere in evidence. The sun came out, and the weather had a settled look about it that nearly drove us mad now that we were confined to inland waters. When the bridges opened for an hour, we towed a net through with a dinghy and out of town. The bridges cost rather a lot there, about 5 or 6 shillings, but we found that those on the canal itself, further on, were free. Next morning at 6 a.m. I hailed a passing motor barge and arranged for a tow to Leiden for 3 guilders, about 5 shillings and 6pence. Progress was splendid, but very soon I discovered we were going northeast. Leiden lay southwest, so I guessed there was something wrong and boarded the barge. The language difficulty made communication rather vague, but Dunsterville, speaking the German of his own particular variety, gathered the proper canal was out of order and that we were going by a roundabout way. We were not a little indignant when we were cast off at Halfweg, a jolly little spot miles out of our course, just like taking a train for Southampton and being landed at Brighton. I gave the boy in charge of the barge 2 guilders and left him grumbling. He had certainly wasted some oil, but he had also been a great nuisance to us, although probably not intentionally. Our conversation had been, "Hi, are you going to Leiden?" Answer, "Half an egg." "Leiden?" I'd yelled. "Is half an egg good for Leiden?" "Yeah." And then offered 2 guilders, and he nodded, but added as an afterthought, "Half an egg, 3 gulden. I queried again whether half an egg good for Leiden, and he spoke rapidly in Dutch, so I agreed, trusting to luck. No, he could not be altogether blamed for his share in the game. I had spent many precious moments looking for a place sounding like half an egg on the Dutch map, but had found none. Now that we were stranded there, I found the name Halfweg in an instant. It was almost a suburb of Amsterdam. For the rest of the morning, we proceeded by our own efforts. We had no difficulty in finding our way with the aid of the map. We sailed a net when we could, and when we came to a reach of a canal where there was a headwind, we towed her. In the afternoon, we managed to get a fast tow from a powerful milk barge going to Delft. It cost us 5 guilders, about 9 shillings, but we were ready to pay anything to get clear of the damn land. Our one object now was to get to the open sea before the weather turned bad again. Some of the country we passed through was very attractive and well worth seeing. Pretty villages and cottages, little lakes and rush-lined canals. As we had to get along as quickly as possible, there was no question of casting off from the barge and proceeding on the canals at more leisurely pace to appreciate the surroundings. Near Delft, the barge stopped, and we had to carry on again by ourselves. But before we had been 5 minutes on our own, we were run down. The canal was made narrower at that point by a string of barges tied to the bank, and we were slowly sailing along, just getting way on. Another barge was overtaking, and another was approaching under power from the opposite direction. We saw the difficulty, and as Annette was hardly moving, we hastily stopped her alongside one of the ships moored to the bank. The barge overtaking was being propelled by quaint poles and was only partially under control. The barge coming from the other direction was in a hurry and would not stop. There was a sickening crunch, and Annette was hit a heavy slanting blow and jammed between the three. The barges crashed past each other and we started to move rapidly sternwards. I went below, expecting to find the timbers broken, but fortunately, no damage at all was done, except for loss of paint and scarred topsides. We were delayed 3/4 of an hour at the next bridge, but managed to get a tow from there to Rotterdam for 4 guilders, 7 shillings and 6 pence. It was soon dark, and the canal was crowded from The Hague to Rotterdam. It was very exciting, steering Annette in the black night, as she tried to sheer wildly about in the wake of a big motor barge. It was getting late, and her skipper was in a hurry, so we were rushed through the water at a good 7 knots. In our headlong ride, we passed by roads crowded with motors, bicycles, and people. At headlong speed, we raced past factories, streets, and houses. I tried to divide my attention between avoiding other ships, not always easy to see, and looking at the shore. A great gas factory loomed up to starboard, lit by orange flares, with an orange-tinted fountain playing in the foreground. Fireworks were being let off, and the banks were crowded, always with jeering, singing people. We passed a bridge over which trams were crossing, barely slowing up at all, as at the last moment the bridge flung open its span to let us through. There it was more crowded than ever. Chinese lanterns, fireworks, and the glare of distant Rotterdam lit up the dark forms of the people and shone on their pale faces and hands. On we went, and then we were whipped along a quieter part, where the canal was flanked on one side by the backs of houses and by a hedge on the other. We were now approaching Rotterdam, and our bewildered rush was at an end. We were ignominiously cast off, as a big bridge would not open to our high mast, and the tug was able to get under, as it had neither mast nor funnel. We were near the sluice, a skipper explained in English, and would be able to proceed early on the morrow. As a matter of fact, we were not able to get away early next day, as the bridge refused to open until 8:30 a.m, when they phoned up the harbour master and inquired whether it might be opened for a little English yacht, with a mast that would not come down. The bridge usually opens at certain hours when 2 or more ships with high masts are waiting. They only opened to us alone as a courtesy to a foreigner. We had to get another bridge to open for us and hold up a crowded main street with a double line of trams before we got to the sluice and out into tidal waters. Chapter 14. The Last Lap. The canal by which we had entered Rotterdam is very rarely used by ships with fixed masts, and our fixed mast seemed to be a subject of indignation to the harbour master. The canal was crowded with barges of from 50 to several hundred tons that gave no trouble, and it seemed very wrong that little Annette of 2 tons should hold up the traffic of 2 much-used thoroughfares. Annette, if she were registered, would run to about 2 or 3 tons, according to the opinion of harbour authorities in Holland, Dover and New Haven. A 6.7 tons Thames measurement is due to her exceptional beam and to the fact that the formula recognises no other dimensions except length. With our usual luck, we met a fresh southwest headwind by the time we had got down the Maas on the ebb to the hook. The sea outside would be bad, so as the wind was unfavourable, we put into our old berth at the hook. The bobstay tore the bolt out of the stem shortly before we tied up. We spent a very pleasant day talking to old friends and going over old ground. The little village had, of course, shared in the Jubilee festivities. Even the chocolates and chinaware in the shops were tied up with orange ribbon and labelled Jubilee. The Hook is one of the very best harbours on the continent for yachts, clean and quiet, a great relief after the canals. Next morning, September the 5th, it was blowing hard west-southwest, so we were unable to get underway before the evening, when it moderated a little. We started with 2 reefs down, but met a terrific sea in the entrance between the moles. The wind was bringing the sea foam across the North Sea and piling it up against the ebb tide of the Maas. A steamer came driving past, jumping like a cork and literally taking it green over the bows. Although we might have found better conditions farther out, we did not like it and so turned back. Thursday, September the 6th. We really did get away at last at 6:30 a.m. with a nice northwest breeze. The swell was still high, but we were no sooner clear of the hook than we were almost becalmed, and the wind slowly backed to southwest. However, we kept on tacking all day and all night, until at dawn we were off a light ship, the Schuwen. The mouth of the Schelde is a dirty place for sailors. It is as bad as the Elbe, with hot tides and the sands extending miles to sea. The wind had freshened all night, and by morning we had to reef. There was a considerable swell, as it had not had time to settle down properly since the last gale. We set a course to pick up a buoy. We found it right enough, and felt our way with the lead across a bank with a vile sea running over it, in 2.5 fathoms. We then laid a course for Walcheren, the most westerly of the Dutch islands, but our calculation for tide was not sufficient, and we were carried to the west of the island over some shallows in 1.5 fathoms. We had to reef again, and things got most unpleasant. We ran with wind abeam about 50 yards off the west shore of Walcheren for flushing. I had put a new bolt on the bobstay, but it broke again, so I had to reef right down to avoid accidents. The least trouble, and a net would go on a lee shore, and the surf did not sound at all pleasant. Annette's bowsprit is very short, but in spite of that, it was surprising how it stood the strain of the foresail after the stay had parted. We ran up the channel to Flushing without further difficulty and passed through the locks into the inner harbour. Having had a meal and put our clothes out to dry, we turned in early, hoping to start again at midnight. Our luck changed next day and the wind veered east. We were able to get away in the early morning on the ebb. The wind was very light, but the tide carried us past Zeebrugge and enabled us to creep into Ostend at 10 a.m. Having changed, shaved and put a net in order, we went ashore. We enjoyed a good lunch at a restaurant, having lived on ship's provisions for some days, and it was a great joy to be able to buy English papers. We also bought some stores and filled the water tank. We found the town very cheerful. Ostend in the sun of a fine September day is a very attractive spot, and we were tempted to stay there a day or two. However, weather is a queer thing, and if scorned when fair, it is apt to repay the offender with gales and rain. Therefore, we took advantage of what it offered and sailed away with the tide at 3:30. I took 3 hours watch, then Dunstable 6, then myself 6, and so on. It was very pleasant gliding along the Belgian coast with a peaceful following breeze. When leaving Ostend, we noticed they were engaged in the harbour in removing the wreck of HMS Vindictive. It was a low tide, and we looked with interest at the rusty bones of the old ship. Passing Newport, we saw a sand yacht tearing along the smooth, clean shore at a tremendous speed, rather a good and certainly a very exciting sport, I should imagine. The Belgian seacoast is undoubtedly doing well financially. Most of the houses have been rebuilt and little traces of war can be seen from the sea. The only scars I saw were the Vindictive and the ruins of the cathedral at Ostend. We passed Dunkirk and then worked out seawards, over the corner of the sands, with the lead in 1.5 fathoms. With Annette's shallow draft, there was no need to use the Zuidcoot Pass, which is the usual channel out between the shoals off the northeast of France. We sailed on all night in comfort. Navigation was very easy, as we had the powerful lights of Dunkirk and Cap Grisnez to help us, and towards morning made out the South Foreland. The glass was falling, and the wind freshening, so at 2 a.m. I altered course from Dungeness and set for Dover. Dawn soon broke on an angry sky and over a leaden sea, so our surprise can be imagined when at 5 a.m. we found ourselves becalmed off Dover in the sun of a perfect day. The tide was fast carrying us north, so I hailed a tug that had been hovering about in the vicinity and offered the skipper 10 shillings to tow me 100 yards to the east entrance of the harbour, but he took no notice, so we dropped anchor. Not many minutes later, we heard cheering and looked out. The tug was lowering a boat, and I saw the black spot in the water. We found out afterwards that the tug was accompanying the channel swimmer, Toth, who had been carried by the tide into St. Margaret's Bay, north of Dover. After the exertions of the past few days, we were keen to get some sleep, but we were forced to remain for some hours anchored in a swell before getting into Dover. On arrival, the customs visited us and gave us pratique, also a very important-looking stores list, which they told me to present at Southampton and, in spite of all my remonstrances, insisted on putting under seal all the liquors that we had brought from Germany. In the afternoon, I mended the jaws of the gaff, which had broken in lowering when we anchored off Dover, and then we went to the Hotel Burlington. The cruise back to Southampton was free of incident. We stayed a few days with friends at Seaford, using New Haven as a base for the yacht. When first we entered the latter port, it was night, and there was the dickens of a hullabaloo when, in response to a hail, I shouted we were from Copenhagen. The harbour master thought we were pulling his leg. Simultaneously, a customs officer plaintively demanded whether we had a seal on board. It was on the tip of my tongue to answer that we had put it overboard, as it would not eat anything, but I gathered this might add to the confusion. So instead I meekly replied, "I have a seal, pratique, and a stores book issued at Dover." His Majesty's Customs, however, seemed to believe that I could not have resisted the temptation to break the seal, so that had to be examined, and a man had to be paid harbour dues, and the Coast Guard had to have further particulars, and the yacht next to us had to know when we were leaving, and so on. Two other yachts came in, so we were deserted whilst the fuss was directed at the newcomers. While we were at New Haven, we heard news of the Ingrid. Jolly and Buster had sailed and navigated her straight from Heligoland to Dover. It must have been hard work for a crew of two. After leaving Dover, they anchored off Seaford in an offshore wind and went ashore for dinner. Whilst they were enjoying their first square meal for a week, the wind shifted, putting Ingrid on a lee shore and freshened. They hurried back to her, but found it necessary to get the assistance of a tug, as it appeared that the yacht had already dragged her anchor. A salvage claim followed, which marred the result of an otherwise remarkably successful cruise. There is one thing that I forgot to mention, and that is the firing of my revolver. We felt it would mar the success of the whole cruise if it were not used, but as it was so rusty and dirty, it would probably burst, and neither of us was enthusiastic to have first shot. The problem was solved off Dungeness by lashing it down to the anchor, putting a slip knot round the trigger and leading the cord to the cabin. We lashed the tiller and then, retiring to the safety of the cabin, pulled the string. Bang! Our revolver was fired and our honour saved. We sailed away from New Haven on Sunday, September the 16th, on the last lap of our voyage. We got underway at 4 p.m. and even for this last passage we had a headwind. It was a hard slog down channel, but uneventful except for the jaws of the gaff breaking again and meeting a very rough sea over the Owers Shoals, south of Selsey Bill, which we crossed at low water spring tides. At the very end, the weather relaxed in our favour and backed south, so we finished the voyage with a fair wind at Southampton Water and anchored off the Southampton Pier at 10 a.m. the following day. The cruise was ended. Allowing for tacking, Annette had sailed about 2,000 miles. It had been a hard cruise, and at times a very wet one, whether on deck or cooped up below in Annette's diminutive cabin, but we had enjoyed it. We had sailed foreign, in strange waters, visiting countries new to us, meeting many interesting people, and widening our experience. Above all, we had accomplished what we set out to do. Well, that's the end of In Broken Water by Adlard Coles, but before we go, I want to go back to that preface to the second edition, which was printed in 1956, which I think is easier to understand and easier to reflect on now we've listened to the whole story. Here we go, the preface to the second edition. In Broken Water was my first book, and the cruise described in it was my first long cruise. As a book, it had its defects, and mistakes were made in sailing through lack of experience, but as it was written in the spirit of adventure, and at a time when every landfall was new, it has, I think, a certain freshness and zest. There is, besides, a measure of historic interest, for since the book was first written, there has been something of a revolution in small boat sailing. In 1923, the accepted idea of a good small cruising yacht was a straight-stemmed, transom-sterned, heavy-displacement boat. Annette, in which I cruised to the Baltic, was, on the contrary, of racing type, and of comparatively light displacement and light scantlings. But for her immense beam, she might be a forerunner of the light displacement type of yacht, which came into vogue after the Second World War. The cruise along the coasts of Holland and Germany, and in the Baltic, was about 1,600 miles in direct distances made good. In 1923, the voyage was regarded by many as hazardous, more on account of the yacht's racing character than her small size. Similarly, in 1950, some yachtsmen regarded Samuel Pepys and Coho as unfit to race across the Atlantic. Indeed, both Annette and Coho in their time were condemned by conservative cruising men as being unsuitable to go outside the Solent. Since 1950, matters of course have gone a step further, and the Atlantic is cheerfully challenged by boats like Nova Espero and Sopranino of about half the size of Annette. I cannot claim originality in the cruise to the Baltic. On the contrary, the cruise was inspired by the Riddle of the Sands and the Falcon on the Baltic, and I humbly followed in the footsteps of Erskine Childers and E.F. Knight, though I doubt whether either would have approved of Annette as a camp follower. In the light of later experience, I regard Annette, as decked in for the cruise, as a boat which was quite capable of crossing the Atlantic. Nevertheless, the cruise in 1923 was quite an exciting one. For one thing, the weather was bad. For another, Germany was on the verge of revolution. Annette's arrival in that country coincided with the inflation bubble and the crash of the mark. Politics were seething in the pre-Nazi era, and as related, the yacht was stolen by members of the Ludendorff Party. Things were fairly desperate at that time, and maybe we were lucky in only losing the yacht. Certainly, the German police showed no desire to come to conclusions with the thieves. For these reasons, there was an exceptional amount of incident in this cruise, and the yarn may be of greater interest after the passage of years. At any rate, I hope so. Another point which may interest new readers is that of prices. Annette was a six-tonner and only 3 years old when I bought her. The price I paid was £180, and the sum I received when I sold her 2 years later was £150. She was built of soft timber and iron-fastened, and for this reason I had the utmost difficulty in finding a purchaser. Nobody wanted to buy a boat with iron fastenings which, it was said, can only last a few years. Well, there we go. That's everything from In Broken Water by Adlard Coles. A little note, in my research before I read this book, I discovered that Adlard Coles, upon selling Annette, bought Racundra from Arthur Ransome, a book which we've read here on the Mariner's Library. You'll find it with the title Racundra's First Cruise. Now, if you'd like to show some support for the podcast and keep the information held within these fantastic books available for the next generation, go over to patreon.com/themariner, and there for $5 a month, you can help keep the lights on. Well, that's all for now, but we'll be back with a new book in the next episode of The Mariner's Library. Cheers for now.